So we're picking up in Pirkei Avos, Perek Aleph, and today we're going to try to do Mishnayos Ches and Tes, 8 and 9, which I think, as we'll see, are very much connected to one another. So in Mishnah Ches, in 8, we read, Yehuda ben Tabai, Bishima ben Shetach, Kiblu Mehem. After Yehoshua ben Prachya and Itai Harbeli, who were the previous link in the chain of the Mesorah, so the next Gedolei Hadar were Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach, again the Nasi and the Av Bezdin, the president and the vice president respectively of the Sanhedrin. So Yehuda ben Tabai Omer, Yehuda ben Tabai used to say, Altas asmecha ka'orchei hadayonim. Don't make yourself like the orchei hadayonim. What are orchei hadayonim? So if you look in the art school translates it as don't act as a lawyer. I don't think the intent is to say that don't go to law school, but we'll have to try to understand what that means over here. Clearly in modern day Hebrew, an orech din is a lawyer. What does that mean exactly over here? They didn't really have lawyers in the sense in which we have them today. So different Mefarshim interpret this differently. First of all, we should just note that Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the great Rishonim, in his commentary on Pirkei Avos says that you should never seek to be the head judge. That's the intent of Altas Atzmecha Ka'archei Hadayonim. What is that? How do you get that out of the words? So he points out that the word arich, spelled with an aleph, actually often means the head of something. It's actually interesting. It's kind of like the idea of being rich, of reich, you know, at the very, very top of something. So, you should not seek to be the head dayan. You know, don't be somebody who's professionally climbing in that way. Be a dayan, try to bring justice, but don't seek to climb towards the top, because very often that will involve you doing things which, maybe you're not so legitimate in that climb towards the top. Most Mefarshim don't interpret the phrase in that fashion. And again, starting with the Rambam and his commentary on Pirkei Avos, they tend to interpret as follows. There are times when serving as a judge that you can feed the litigants what to say in a way that may be technically okay, but is nonetheless unsavory. What do we mean by this? So the Rambam says clearly, if you're a judge, or you're anybody, forget about being a judge, if you encourage somebody to make a claim in court which is false, that's clearly wrong, that's clearly unethical and immoral, and you don't need Yehuda ben Tabai telling you, I came up with a chiddush, a novel idea, you shouldn't teach people to lie in court. So that's obvious, that's clearly not what's being discussed over here. However, sometimes you can have a situation where you could advise someone to make a claim in court which is true, which will work to their advantage, but nonetheless it can sometimes be unsavory to look like you're manipulating the system. What's an example thereof? So the Rambam quotes a Gemara in Ksubas, Daf Nun Beis, where the Gemara tells the following story. We know that a husband has various obligations vis-a-vis his wife. One obligation that he has vis-a-vis his wife is mizonos, what's called mizonos, the notion that he has to pay for her food. He has to support her, during the time that they're married to one another. A second obligation that the husband has towards his wife is the ksuba. We oftentimes think of the ksuba as a document, as, a nice document that some people like to hang on their walls. But in point of fact, the ksuba is actually a sum of money which is set aside. It's the property of the wife, and in the case of death or divorce, that sum of money then is given to the wife in order to support her after the death or divorce in which has terminated the marriage. That's actually referred to as the ksuba itself. The question arises in the Gemara in Ksubas, if the woman is sick, if the wife becomes sick, so it's the husband's obligation to pay for her medical bills, which sum of money should he access to pay for her medical bills? Is it something that's part of the mizonos, the regular payment, which he's obligated to give to her during the marriage? Or is that something in which he can dip into the ksuba to pay for her medical expenses? Obviously, from, again, if we look at it financially, obviously the ideal is that the husband shouldn't be asking these kind of questions, that he should want to pay the doctor because he loves his wife, right? But if we just look at it in a purely financial sense, from the husband's point of view, he would be happy to dip into the ksuba, because again, that's money which is sitting in escrow anyway for his wife. He can't touch it otherwise, so might as well save himself some money and dip into the ksuba to pay for her medical expenses. On the other hand, from the wife's perspective, she would much rather that the medical bills come out of mizonos. In other words, the leave my ksuba intact and let the husband shell out, you know, the money for the doctor, you know, from money, from cash that he has, you know, not to dip into the escrow, which is set aside for the wife. So the Gemara there says that it depends what money he uses, what money he's entitled to use, depends on what the nature of the sickness is. If it's a chronic sickness, so then the husband has to pay mizonos, because if you think about it, if it's a chronic sickness and he dips into the ksuba to pay for that money, you won't have any ksuba left at a certain point, right? He's got to keep dipping month after month, you know, to pay for her sickness, and it's not going to work. If it's a one-time thing, you know, or something which is not chronic, so then he does have the right to dip into the ksuba. The Gemara then raises the question, what's that? And he doesn't necessarily have to pay it back yet, right? So in other words, you know, this is that's part of the deal, you know. In other words, I'm providing for you, but you know, some kind of, again, to put it into a modern day context, you know, some unexpected major medical expense, you know, he may not have the cash on hand, so the ksuba was a substantial sum of money, so you know, he was given the right to dip into that in order to pay for the medical expense.
People actually have a...
Okay, so back in the day they did. Back in the day they did. No, again, right. Right, no, 100%. There are various reasons why, you know, today there is no ksuba account, which is sitting in the bank account. But back in the day, again, without getting into the reasons, back in the day they actually had money set aside for the ksuba. And when, right, yeah, essentially. For, you're right. Right, it was insurance, you know, in the case of death or divorce. And really, that's what the text of the ksuba is all about. All that stuff that they read very quickly under the chuppah is really about all the money, you know, that's being set aside, you know, and how much money is being set aside. You go to a, yeah. You go to a Sephardi wedding today, they put in real amounts. They put in real amounts. I mean, it's not real amounts because they don't really set aside that amount of money, but they do write actual amounts into the ksuba. In dollar amounts, yeah. Yeah. Well, Sfardim do. Sfardim actually have real dollar amounts that's when the ksuba. Exaggerated. Not, they don't really have an account set aside either, but they at least have it. So where this comes in relevant to us in our discussion is the Gemara discusses a phenomena which is no longer a current phenomena. Where does bloodletting fit into the picture? Again, we don't do bloodletting. But back in the day, that was the standard form of administering, you know, medicine. You know, every once in a while, you know, like going for your physical, every once in a while you went to the doctor, he let out some blood, and then life was good again after that, until it wasn't. And then he went back and he let out some more blood, and they, you know, they saw that as being the medicine. Is bloodletting considered to be a chronic need? Or is it considered to be a one-time need? In other words, can you dip into the ksuba to pay for your wife's bloodletting? Or is that something that you're not allowed to dip into the ksuba for? So it wasn't quite clear. So the Gemara, so this is where it comes to us. The Gemara tells the story of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, again, we know is one of the greatest Amoraim described in the Gemara. Rabbi Yochanan says the Gemara in ksubas had a relative whose stepmother apparently needed chronic bloodletting, and she was trying to claim that her husband should have to pay the money out of the ksuba, and the husband was claiming that I don't want to dip into the ksuba. You know, the wife was claiming that she should be entitled to the money from mizonos. Don't dip into the ksuba. The husband claimed that, no, I'm entitled to dip into the ksuba to pay off the expense of the bloodletting. So Rabbi Yochanan called this fellow aside because he was a relative, and he wanted to give him good legal advice. What was the good legal advice? So says the Gemara, he called over the fellow and he said, go tell your mother to make a deal with the bloodletter that she'll pay him for his, that he should be available whenever she needs him, you know, to be able to let her blood. If they make that deal, the Beis Din will then consider bloodletting in her case to be a chronic condition, because after all, she paid up front, you know, a sum of money that he should be available whenever she needed him. That clearly speaks to the fact that it's chronic. And then she'll be able to avoid dipping into the ksuba. After he gave this advice, says the Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan later regretted it. And in the words of the Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan said, "Osisi atmi ke'arche hadayonim." I failed to follow the advice of Yehuda ben Tabai. I made myself, quote unquote, into a lawyer. Now again, so the Rambam quotes that Gemara in our context to explain as follows, right? The advice that Rabbi Yochanan gave this relative was truthful. It was not a shtick, so to speak. It was not encouraging him to lie in any way. But in a sense, Rabbi Yochanan was teaching him how to work the system for his stepmother's advantage. Now again, she wasn't working the system in a unfair or immoral kind of way, but Rabbi Yochanan felt that it takes away from the position of the dayan to encourage people or to advise people to use the system in any way whatsoever, you know, which is to their advantage. Now, of course, we know in modern day America, this is exactly what you pay. This is what you pay a lawyer to do. You pay a lawyer, you pay an accountant to try to figure out how to work the system legally to your advantage. You know, the accountant is supposed to go over, you know, your finances and figure out the legitimate way in which you can pay the least amount of taxes. If he figures out an illegitimate way for you to pay the least amount of taxes, that's bad. That's illegal. But he's supposed to. You'll end up in jail. The accountant will end up in jail. That's not a good thing. But it is his job to try to figure out legitimately how you can minimize the amount of taxes that you pay. We don't see anything wrong with that. And again, it's not really wrong. But Yehuda ben Tabai was saying, and we'll come back to this a little in a few moments, Yehuda ben Tabai was saying, it may not be wrong, but again, it does take away from the stature of the dayan a little bit, of the judge a little bit, if he's perceived even in some way as being a wheeler dealer. You know, somebody who's trying to figure out the best way to game the system. I guess not. Right. I guess, though, that the advice that the Beis Din will look at it a certain way if you pay the bloodletter up front is not something that way of looking at it, he probably wouldn't have figured out on his own. So that's the Rambam, and most of the Mefarshim understand. That's what's going on over here. Yehuda ben Tabai is saying, if you're a dayan, if you're a judge, don't get involved in helping people figure out the best way, even legitimately, to game the judicial system. It just takes away from the stature we associate with the dayan. Point number two, kshuyiyu bali hadin omdim lefanecha, yu beinecha kirishoim. When you're a judge and the litigants are standing in front of you, you should view them as rishoim, as wicked people. Really? I thought we said you're not supposed to view people as wicked people. Right, so what the Mefarshim over here explain is as follows. If you're a judge and you just believe that everybody is innocent and angelic and wonderful, you're not doing your job as a judge. There's something called due diligence in the role of being a judge, and what that involves is, let's assume that this guy is lying, right? In other words, let's weigh everything that he says and try to find evidence to support it. If I take the words of the litigant at face value as a judge, I'm not really doing my job. And in fact, that's true. I mean, we know today, not just for judges, but for anyone who has to evaluate anything in any context. The person is a teacher. So on the day of the final, one of the students comes up to the teacher and says, look, you know me. I've been in the class this entire semester. I don't really need to take the final. You know that I know the material, right? So it would be a very foolish teacher who would say, yes, I am don you l'chav z'chus, I judge you favorably, and assume that you know all of the material, there's no need for me to test it by giving you the final. It would be a very foolish teacher indeed, you know, who would take that position. Now again, does that mean we're saying that the student doesn't know? You know, that we're saying the student's a rasha or anything like that? No, we're just saying we can't, our due diligence demands that we can't take anything on face value, we can't assume anything until we can demonstrate it in some way. So if you're a litigant, I can't assume, that's what Yehuda ben Tabbai says, I have to assume you're a rasha. Not really, but in other words, I can't assume the veracity of anything you're telling me until I can actually establish it. On the other hand, when you're a judge and the case has been resolved and now the litigants are leaving, you should view them as if they are totally innocent. Why? Because they accepted the judgment upon themselves. Meaning, once we've ruled that Reuven owes Shimon $1,000 and he pays the money, so we don't hold any grudge against Reuven. We don't say, oh, he's a rasha, he's a terrible person. Even if in court it comes out that Reuven was a thief and he stole $1,000 from Shimon, and that's why we forced him to pay back Shimon the $1,000, after he does so, we assume that he does tshuva, and we don't look at him any differently, even though in court we establish that he had done something wrong. Once the court case is over, we switch hats, so to speak. We no longer have that hat of the due diligence of the judge, and we assume that he did everything correctly, he repented, he did tshuva, and you know, he goes on with his life. Clearly, all three things that Yehuda ben Tabbai is saying over here relate primarily to judges, which again was his job, he was the head of the Sanhedrin, and they speak about the kind of relationship that the judge has to have with the litigant and with the people that he deals with in general. A similar kind of idea is articulated by Shimon ben Shetach in the next Mishnah. Shimon ben Shetach Omer, have a marbe lachkar es ha'edim. You should take pains to interrogate the witnesses thoroughly. Have a zor bidvarecha, shema mitocham yomudu l'shake. And be very, very careful with the kind of things that you ask the witnesses, because as we say, you know, as the term is used in you know, in civil courts today, you don't want to lead the witness, you don't want to encourage the witness to lie. Be very careful how you phrase the questions and the statements that you make as a judge, because if you phrase things wrongly, you can actually, you know, feed information to the witnesses, and then that would mess up the case and take away the justice which is trying to be served over here. Yehuda ben Tabbai deals with how the judge deals with litigants. Shimon ben Shetach deals with how the judge deals with witnesses. But the common denominator is they're both talking to judges and how to make sure that the justice system is as pristine as it can possibly be. And I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, okay, this is very nice. I'm not a dayan. I'm not a judge. I'm just the average reader of Pirkei Avos. What are you telling me that I need to know in terms of these court procedures? I'm not going to be in the situation where I'm interrogating witnesses. I'm not in the situation where I'm adjudicating between litigants. I'm just sitting on a Shabbos afternoon and reading Pirkei Avos. So what do I take away from all of this discussion? Right? Which I think is a fair question. Clearly, you know, all of these statements in the first part of Pirkei Avos are meant to be statements for the average person, right? Pirkei Avos are the great messages that these Tanoim wanted to share with everybody. Why are these messages, which are primarily a handbook for Dayanim, for judges, why are they relevant to the average person? So I think the answer lies in appreciating a little bit of the biographies of Yehuda ben Tabbai and Shimon ben Shetach. And particularly when it comes to Shimon ben Shetach, we actually have a lot of information in the Gemaras about his life and times, and we have a little bit about Yehuda ben Tabbai as well. And when we put all of these statements together, all of the biographical stories that we have about both of them, I think it gives us a heightened insight into, you know, why it's important for the average person, not just for the judge, to be aware of these statements that they're making. Let's go back to something we discussed over the past two times. So Shimon ben Shetach, the Gemara says, was the brother-in-law of Alexander Yanai, this Hasmonean king, the descendant of the Hashmonaim, who had started out his career being loyal to Torah and tradition, but was seduced at some point by one of his advisors to turn against the Rabbanon, you know, to murder them. He forced Yoshua ben Prachya, who was the head of the Sanhedrin at that time, to go into hiding, to run to Alexandria. Shimon ben Shetach, who was on the Sanhedrin at that time, went into hiding from his own brother-in-law. And it was only after the passage of time that the wife of Yanai HaMelech, Shlomtzion HaMalka, was able to convince her husband to calm down. You know, the rabbis are your friends, they're not your enemies. And Shimon ben Shetach, her brother, was allowed to come out of hiding, right? He was able to send word to Yoshua ben Prachya to come back from Alexandria. And it seems like things at that point settled down a little bit, and, you know, the rabbis were once again able to function in society. But the damage clearly had been done. I mean, for the king to persecute the Rabbanon and try to kill them, and to show an utter disregard for the rule of law, meant that there was a tremendous damage to the power that the Sanhedrin had in Jewish life, and the ability of the Rabbanon to adjudicate, to carry out laws, to basically enforce the rule of Torah law in Eretz Yisrael. And this was damage that had been done by the king himself. If we look at the various stories that concern Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai, they all seem to focus on the idea that Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai worked tirelessly to restore the rule of law in Eretz Yisrael after they came out of hiding. You know, Yanai had damaged the rule of Torah law in Eretz Yisrael. Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai were going to put that rule of law back in force and show the people that a strong Sanhedrin, a strong Beis Din, was absolutely necessary in order to make sure that Torah law would be followed by the Jewish people. And clearly we want Torah law to be followed by the Jewish people. So let's just share a couple of stories and we'll see how this picture really emerges. Yeah? Not clear, but... Right. Yeah, so I would imagine in a case like that, you know, even for the king to go out and, you know, start massacring the Rabbanon, he probably had a lot of support, right? So in other words, it wasn't so simple to just say, oh, it's only the king who's the problem. You know, there was probably a lot of support within the people, you know, that and you know, people probably turned against the Rabbanon, because after all, if the rabbis are the enemies of the king, so then we don't like the rabbis either, right? And it was that probably was an issue that had to be corrected in Klal Yisrael. So to take a couple of examples, right? So the Gemara in Sanhedrin relates how the Mishnah writes that the Sanhedrin never sits in judgment on a king. Why? So the Gemara tells the following story. Yanai had a slave who killed someone. Shimon ben Shetach, who was apparently running the Sanhedrin at that time, again, it's not clear from the Gemara whether this is before the massacre or after the massacre, but if Shimon ben Shetach is the one who's running the Sanhedrin, it seems that this would be after the massacre. Shimon ben Shetach said, you know, if Yanai's slave killed someone, then Yanai, as the slave owner, bears a degree of responsibility. We have to judge Yanai as well. So they called Yanai into court. Shimon ben Shetach was presiding, and, you know, they judged him. And Shimon ben Shetach said, you know, you should be held responsible for the murder that was committed by your slave. Who agrees with me? And the Gemara describes very, very memorably how Shimon ben Shetach turns to his right, and all of the Chachamim who are gathered at his right look down at their feet. Shimon ben Shetach turns to his left, and all of the Chachamim to his left look down at their feet. In other words, nobody is brave enough to agree with Shimon ben Shetach that Yanai should be held responsible for the murder committed by his slave. Shimon ben Shetach then... What's that? Everybody was conveniently looking down at their feet right about then. Right? I'm sorry? It's interesting, right? You know, it's a good question. You know, how did he sit in judgment on a brother-in-law? Right. I don't know. It's a good question. Right. Okay. It's pretty close. Right. I don't know. It's a good question. In any case, the Gemara describes how nobody wanted. You know, Shimon ben Shetach alone courageously stood up against Yanai HaMelech in this regard. Nobody else was willing to stand with him. Shimon ben Shetach turned to his colleagues and said, "You know what's right. If you're not going to do what's right, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to come and do what's right." And the Gemara describes how a Malach came and struck down the rest of the Chachamim. Again, it's not clear how the court case ended at that point, because I guess they defaulted. It wasn't really a court to be able to try Yanai HaMelech. But the point of this story for our purposes is Shimon ben Shetach was fearless and was ready to take on the king himself, maybe even after this incident with the massacre, which, again, if you think about it at that point, it certainly would have scared the other Chachamim to go up against Yanai HaMelech. We could understand why they were scared. But Shimon ben Shetach wasn't scared. If the din says that we have to do X, so this is the din, and we're going to carry it out, and we don't care, you know, how powerful you are subject to the rule of law. That's one story told by the Gemara in the second chapter of Sanhedrin. Another story, this time by a Mishnah later in Sanhedrin. The Mishnah says that two people are not supposed to be executed by the Sanhedrin on the same day. Right? To try a capital case requires a lot of thought and concentration. And if the Sanhedrin becomes a mill, so to speak, where they're just seeing people and judging cases, you know, 20 minutes, 20 minutes, 20 minutes, 20 minutes, it takes away from the gravity of what needs to be involved when a capital case is being judged. So the Mishnah says, wait a minute, but Shimon ben Shetach once condemned 80 women to death on the same day in Ashkelon, because all of these women were involved in witchcraft in some form or another. Right? We know that various forms of witchcraft, which are prohibited by the Torah and punishable by death. So all these various women, they were, you know, soothsayers and whatever. So he tried them all on the same day and put them to death all on the same day, 80 women in Ashkelon. The Gemara goes on to explain that, you know, the truth is, under normal circumstances, you're not allowed to do that. You know, the Mishnah is correct that normally you don't judge more than one person on the same day in a capital case. Shimon ben Shetach saw that there was a tremendous problem in Klal Yisrael with regard to the practice of witchcraft. So, you know, he sent out people to, obviously, you know, to be put to death. It's not like the Salem witch trials, Lahavdil. You know, to be put to death in a Jewish court, you have to have witnesses, you have to be warned that you're not allowed to do this. You know, there has to be, the witnesses have to see that the person was actually doing, you know, what would be described as acts of witchcraft, however you describe what those are exactly. So Shimon ben Shetach put those procedures in place and moved quickly to execute many, many people on the same day to show that, you know, the rule of law had to be established in Eretz Yisrael. That's the second story in the Gemara. The third story in the Gemara comes from the Gemara in Makos, which involves both Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai. So the Torah speaks of a phenomena called Edim Zomimim. Edim Zomimim means that when witnesses come and bear testimony, let's say that so-and-so is a murderer, and then a second group of witnesses come and say, you can't say that so-and-so was a murderer. You were with us when you claimed that the murder actually happened. You claimed the murder happened in Los Angeles. But at the very time that you claimed the murder to have taken place, you were with us in San Diego, and it's not possible for you to have been in two places at once. So whatever the witnesses sought to impose on the defendant now goes on to the witnesses. So if the witnesses wanted the defendant to be put to death as part of a murder trial, so the defendants, the witnesses themselves would be put to death instead of the defendant. Okay. The Tzdukim, the Sadducees, held that the Edim Zomimin would only be put to death if the defendant had been executed. So in other words, if they were successful in having the defendant put to death, then they would, and then subsequently it came out that they were lying, so then they would be put to death. But if they had not been successful in having the defendant executed, so they would not get their punishment. The Torah Shebaal Peh, as represented by the rabbis, actually teaches that the opposite is true. Again, why that is a whole discussion in itself, but that's not really our focus. The Torah Shebaal Peh teaches the opposite is true. If the defendant is put to death, the Edim Zomimim are not punished. If the defendant is still alive, in other words, the truth comes out that the witnesses are lying before the defendant is put to death, that's actually when they're put to death. So with that background, the Gemara tells in Makos that it once happened that one of these cases came before the Sanhedrin, and Yehuda ben Tabai put an Ed Zomim to death before the defendant was executed, and Yehuda ben Tabai said, I made a point of doing this because I wanted to show that the Tzdukim, that the Sadducees are absolutely wrong. I was very happy about this case because it gave me an opportunity to show that the Tzdukim are wrong and that Torah Shebaal Peh is absolutely correct. Now, again, in light of everything we said up till now, we understand why it was particularly important for Yehuda ben Tabai to show the correctness of the Torah Shebaal Peh and the wrongness of the perspective of the Tzdukim. Because after all, Yanai had allied himself with the Tzdukim, who denied the truth of the Torah Shebaal Peh. And this was yet one more example of trying to show the truth of Torah Shebaal Peh through the vehicle of the Sanhedrin. But the story doesn't end there. Shimon ben Shetach said to his colleague, Yehuda ben Tabai, with all due respect, I think you made a mistake. Because the halacha also is that we don't put a single Ed Zomim to death. It's only when both of the witnesses are shown to be lying that we put them both to death. But if, for an example, two witnesses come, and about one, there are witnesses who say he couldn't have been in Los Angeles at that time, he was with us in San Diego, and there are no witnesses about the other witness, so it's a package deal. You can't put one Ed Zomim to death, it has to be two Edim Zomim who are put, it's two or nothing. So, again, apparently Shimon ben Shetach, for whatever reason, was not part of that court case, because otherwise clearly he would have interceded at the time. Says the Gemara, Yehuda ben Tabai was broken by this information that Shimon ben Shetach shared with him, which apparently, again, he was not aware of previously. And Yehuda ben Tabai said, I've killed an innocent man. And for the rest of his life, says the Gemara, Yehuda ben Tabai used to go and visit the grave of that Ed Zomim whom he had put to death. He would wail and weep by the grave to the point where people who were nearby thought that the dead man himself was crying in the cemetery. And, you know, for the rest of his life, till he passed away, Yehuda ben Tabai would constantly go to that grave and bemoan what he had done, because again he really felt correctly, apparently, that it was a miscarriage of justice, that, you know, again unwittingly, but it was a miscarriage of justice which he had carried out. What you see from the whole story, all three of the stories, is this tremendous desire that both Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai had to restore the rule of the Sanhedrin and of Torah law after it had been challenged in such a terrible way by Yanai HaMelech. And I think appreciating that aspect of their biographies helps us understand why they shared these particular ideas and why they're relevant to us, even if we're not Dayanim. To Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai, their whole lives were about restoring the rule of Din Torah and making sure that the Sanhedrin and the Rabbanim and the Beis Din would have power to be able to enable Klal Yisrael at large to be able to adhere to the dinim of the Torah. This was their life's mission. They gave everything to make sure that the Bezdin, that the Sanhedrin would be strong. So it's no wonder that their statements are about how a Bezdin should function. Okay, good, but what does that have to do with you and me? So I think the takeaway is, even if you're not a member of a Bezdin, even if you're not a member of a Sanhedrin, it's important to appreciate how central Din Torah is to the life of a Jew. You know, unfortunately, sometimes even today, you know, two from Jews will get into a monetary dispute with one another, and right away they run to secular court, right? So people oftentimes don't realize it's a very serious issue, right? You're not allowed to go to secular court ordinarily unless, for whatever reason, you know, the Beis Din can't adjudicate it. And again, if you know, you have a dispute with somebody who's not willing to go to Beis Din, so then the Beis Din can allow the person to go to secular court. But in general terms, the Beis Din is supposed to be the address to adjudicate disputes between Jews, and certainly between from Jews, who are willing to accept the authority of the Beis Din. That's the way it's supposed to work. So what we can take away from these statements are all about the Beis Din on its end has to do its utmost to be honest, to be fair, to even go beyond the letter of the law, not even to do things which are not illicit, but, you know, maybe smell bad, you know, to try to tell people, you know, to manipulate the system. The Beis Din shouldn't even do that. And if the Beis Din does its job, which is what Shim ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai were so insistent upon, so, you know, what's incumbent upon us is to do our job, to make use of the Beis Din, you know, to recognize the rule of Din Torah, and to try to, you know, bring that out, to support that as much as we can in every aspect of our religious lives. That I think is really the message that we're supposed to take away from Yehuda ben Tabai and Shim ben Shetach, and, you know, what they're presenting over here. Okay, I want to wish everybody a great week. Yeah. Right. Right. So. Right. So they didn't. They didn't have that historically. You know, that's sort of a later. Well, that's really what he's saying not to do. In other words, the judges should not be Tohanim. I mean, that's really what he's. Oh yeah, in that sense. Right, right. In other words, in the sense that the lawyer is the one who does the cross-examining, you know, in the American legal system. Yeah, so the judges played that role, you know, once upon a time. But again, they're dispassionate as opposed to the lawyer, who has an agenda. You know, hopefully the only agenda of the dayanim is to find the truth. You know, not to represent a particular side. Again, as I mentioned at the beginning, so we'll be off next week, Bezdas Hashem, and we look forward to picking up the following week. And wish everybody a great week.